Welcome to One True Podcast. My name is Mark Chirino, and my producer is Michael Von Cannon. In his memoir, A Movable Feast, Ernest Hemingway wrote, "All you have to do is write one true sentence. Write the truest sentence that you know." So finally, I would write one true sentence and then go on from there. In that same spirit of honesty, creativity, and curiosity, One True Podcast explores all things related to Ernest Hemingway, his life, his work, and his world. Today's show takes Hemingway at his own premise. We ask our guest a very simple question, his choice for Hemingway's one true sentence and why, and then, as Hemingway writes, go on from there. We're delighted to welcome Andre Debuse III today to talk about his choice, to talk about reading and writing and whatever else comes. Andre Debuse III's books include the New York Times bestsellers House of Sand and Fog, The Garden of Last Days, and his memoir, Townie. His most recent novel is the critically acclaimed Gone So Long. Among the many awards he has received, Mr. Debuse has been a finalist for the National Book Award. He has been awarded a Guggenheim Fellowship, the National Magazine Award for Fiction, two Pushcart Prizes, and is a recipient of an American Academy of Arts and Letters Awards in Literature. He also gave the keynote at the 2012 Penn Hemingway Ceremony. Andre, welcome to One True Podcast.
Thanks for having me, Mark. It's a pleasure.
Well, it's great to have you on. So let's start here. What is your one true sentence and why?
Well, I could give you 500 for Hemingway, but it is the opening line of his masterful short story, Hills Like White Elephants. The hills across the valley of the Ebro were long and white.
Okay, so why?
Okay, it's subtle, but it captures what is. And as you know, Hemingway, and you just read that wonderful passage from A Movable Feast, Hemingway was trying to capture life, not just depict it, but to recreate the feeling of being in the experience itself. And in that line, which was actually a pep talk he gave himself in his 20s, living on the West Bank of Paris with his first wife and their little boy, he thought he was all done. You know, he thought, I've published three short stories, but I got nothing left. I'm done. And so he did what all writers have to do at various times. He had to give himself a pep talk and tell himself to keep going. And that's where that line about, I just have to write one true sentence and all will follow. Before I answer your question about this opening line, I want to talk about Flannery O'Connor, who said the following: there is a certain grain of stupidity the writer can hardly do without, and that is the quality of having to stare. He goes on to say that writing is waiting. And it's a line I teach a lot in my creative writing classes because it's so helpful. What she's not saying we're waiting for inspiration. We're waiting for the next piece of the image or the next line or the next part of this beating heart that should happen after you write a true sentence. So, the hills across the valley of the Ebro were long and white. I have to read you the next line. Because that first line, the reason I love it so much, necessarily created the second. On this side, there was no shade and no trees, and the station was between two lines of rails in the sun. Third line. Close against the side of the station, there was the warm shadow of the building and a curtain made of strings of bamboo beads hung across the open door into the bar to keep out flies. So often, you know, we all know that the heart of character-driven fiction is, of course, character. I would argue that the lungs, therefore, is place. And if you don't ground your characters in a real three-dimensional space, a landscape, urban, rural, interior, exterior, what have you, your characters will literally not be able to breathe, and they will stop functioning as real people. So there are many reasons why I think that opening line is the perfect true sentence. But one of those other reasons is not just because it leads to on this side there was no shade, but by grounding us in the place, we are now coming around, Hemingway is now coming around to who is in this place. And so let me just, if I can, read one more line.
Sure, keep going.
The American and the girl with him sat at a table in the shade outside the building. It was very hot, and the express from Barcelona would come in 40 minutes. It stopped at this junction for 2 minutes and went on to Madrid. Now, on one level, you think, well, there's nothing very interesting about all that. It's very informational, almost journalistic. And of course, you know, Hemingway was a reporter and war correspondent in his early years. But it does more than that. I would say it's profluent, what Gardner would call forward movingness, because it all leans towards the opening line. What should we drink? The girl asked. She had taken off her hat and put it on the table. It's pretty hot, the man said. I would argue, as someone who's been, you know, trying to cultivate that Flannery O'Connor, a certain grain of truth and stare and wait for all my adult life, which are a few decades now, I'm grateful to report, it is absolutely essential that we learn to simply wait for the true thing and then reach for the words that get it, that sometimes make that thousand-mile journey from the interior of the writer to the page and ultimately into the reader. And as you know, Hemingway was a pioneer and a master of that. And I'm very grateful to him for it.
That's a wonderful explanation, especially when you're talking, Andre, about place. Because in the sequence that you read, we go from the panorama and a consideration of Spain to the string of bamboo. So when you're talking about place, are you talking about the atmosphere in which the characters are, or the tangible physical room or the chair that they're on, those kinds of concrete actualities?
All of the above, but now we have to talk about John Gardner, who I know you know coined the phrase psychic distance, which means the distance the reader feels from the events of the story. Hemingway's, and I'm sure this wasn't on purpose by Hemingway, but he begins in a very film-like way. The camera's actually panning from far to close, right? The hills across the valley of the Ebro were long and white. And then we come into the train station, and now we're at the table, and now we're at the girl and the man, and they're wondering what they're going to drink. And so it's a wonderful winnowing down of being far away and then moving in closer and closer and closer. And now we are invested in knowing who these people are, where they're going, what are they going to drink. As you know, nothing happens in this story except for what they talk about and the fact that the man is trying to get the woman to do something she doesn't want to do. And it's all through dialogue. And one of the main reasons, too, Mark, that I teach this story a lot is it was written in 19 or maybe published in 1927. And so now it's almost 100 years old. But I never let my students know how old this story is. And a lot of them sadly don't know enough about Hemingway to think about it being almost 100 years old. But they're always shocked because it seems so modern to them. It seems so contemporary to them, even though the language is different. And they're clearly, you know, people from a different time. But I find that remarkable and beautiful.
Are your students that you teach this, are they waiting for action?
Yeah, sadly. And, you know, I won't go on my soapbox about this too much, but I blame the gadgets. You know, I blame the digital age. I blame the fact that we've all sort of become attention deficit disorder from staring at screens too often. It's not just young people, but, you know, people who've been reading all their lives. I don't know if it's happened to you, but I know that my dear friends and loved ones and colleagues, if they're on their phones and screens enough, they can't concentrate on a page the way they used to. And so, yes, they are waiting for action, but I am always moved and beyond pleased, Mark, when it's very rare that a 2021 student of mine doesn't love this story and isn't grateful for very little happening. And, you know, they're smart. They're sensitive. They're alive. They've been around so far. They know what's going on. And so many of them, especially with the male-female relations, identify with a dominant man and a submissive woman. And who's running this relationship and who's going to get hurt.
Right. And so in your Penn Hemingway lecture, you singled this story out among all of Hemingway's stories as an illustration of Hemingway's capturing of the actual,
yes.
of and which feeds right into the one true sentence, that capturing of authenticity. And it's been your experience that students get that
Well, they get that, and again, I don't want to get on my iPhone hating soapbox, but I do think that they've cast so many young people in a bit of a trance. They're on it hours and hours a day. We know that depression and suicide ideation rates have skyrocketed since these things. I think it's made these kids far more self-involved and worried about likes and follows and about things that are not real. And I do believe that in many ways, a Hemingway short story that begins with one true sentence, the way this story begins, can be an antidote to the despair that this whole generation we're in now is feeling. Let me read you, and I know you know this, this quote I love from Hemingway to his dad, a letter to his dad, 1925. I'm sure you know it. "You see, I'm trying in all my stories to get the feeling of the actual life across, not to just depict life or criticize it, but to actually make it alive so that when you read something by me, you actually experience the thing." And you know, I know that Hemingway, and this is his own damn fault, his work has been overshadowed by his outsized macho reputation, which he cultivated. And, you know, there was a lot of ego in there for sure. But where I think that Hemingway is so often misunderstood by modern audiences is that I think they get equally distracted by his larger-than-life bravado image. And the truth is, that bravado is not in his work. His work is full of vulnerability and a quiet sort of wounded stoicism and frankly, depressed men and withdrawn men. And there's very little swinging dick swagger going on in these stories. And I think it's important people know that. Can I read another line? This is from Death in the Afternoon. Can I read?
Yeah, sure. Of course.
From Hemingway. And this is from Death in the Afternoon, nonfiction. "For myself, the problem was one of depiction. And waking in the night, I tried to remember what it was that seemed just out of my remembering. And that was the thing that I had really seen. And finally, remembering all around it, I got it. When he, the matador, stood up, his face white and dirty and the silk of his breeches opened from waist to knee, it was the dirtiness of the rented breeches, the dirtiness of his slit underwear and the clean, clean, unbearably clean whiteness of the thigh bone that I had seen. And it was that which was important." I love that so much. And when I first read this, you know, Death in the Afternoon as a young writer in my 20s, I was so inspired I couldn't sleep for days because I realized, and you know, we all know there are all sorts of writers and all sorts of ways of writing. Doctorow, who is also one of my favorite, I mean, he should have gotten a posthumous Nobel, one of my favorite American writers of the 20th century, E.L. Doctorow, he said famously once, he said, you know, "I just don't think Hemingway loved language." And I'm paraphrasing Doctorow's quote there. I disagree. He espoused all adjectives, all ornamental language, all the scroll work, he called it, to get it down, down, down. Because right. What was he trying to do? He was trying to give the experience, not depict it, but to give the experience of being in, say, a bull ring, watching a matador gored, to give it fully to the reader. And to me, that's such a generous act. It took immense discipline. And you know, thank God Hemingway was able to pull it off many, many times in his life.
This episode of One True Podcast is supported by the Hemingway Review, the scholarly journal of the Ernest Hemingway Foundation and Society. Michael and I read it cover to cover every time we see it. You can buy back issues of the Hemingway Review at hemingwaysociety.org/journals. I'm so glad you mentioned that Death in the Afternoon quote to go along with the letter he wrote to his father. The intersection, or one of them, between your work and Hemingway's work, I would say, is the aptly chosen detail. And so he talks about the breach in the matador. He also says at one point, you know, how do you convey, how could he possibly convey the excitement of fishing? Well, it's the droplet of water bouncing off the taut fishing line, if I capture that. And I think, you know, I'm thinking of Towney more, right, for whatever reason, most specifically, that aptitude that you have for choosing a collection of details or that one detail that will render a lived experience. Is that something that you're conscious of? Is that something you've had to work at?
Oh my God, have I had to work at it? Here's the great line, as you know, from Samuel Beckett: ever tried, ever failed, never mind, try again, fail better. It's so wonderfully Irish. It's encouraging and discouraging. Fail better, for fuck's sake. Anyway, hell yeah, I've worked hard on that. And thank you for the compliment. I write slowly. You know, I've been writing, I'm 61 years old. I've been writing 5 days a week since I was 23. I've only published 7 books. Well, and probably 5 more no one else will see. Why? Because I write slowly and I overwrite. So I will, and there's a wonderful story about Old Man the Sea I want to share. So I will give myself permission to write 200 more pages than I'll use. And the reason I do that is I need to get all the clay on the table and then start to whittle it down, whittle it down, whittle it down. My novel, The Garden of Last Days, which came out in 2008, when I turned what I thought was the finished manuscript into the publisher, it was 880 pages from 14 points of view. And my editor is a brilliant, horribly cruel person. I think, you know, Faulkner said famously, you know, you must murder your darlings. And I think with this editor, Elaine Mason at Norton, I've had for years, been blessed to have. I think she's shown me what a great editor is. They actually give you the rifle, forgive the violent image. Yeah, they point to the darlings you've got to whack. And so in this one, so yes, thank you. I work really hard. And then I shave it down, shave it down, shave it down to try to find the essential detail that does it all. And you know, that it really takes, and Hemingway was the pioneer, I think, and the master of whittling down, whittling down, whittling down to the essence, because I think that takes immense, you've got to so let go of how hard it was to write those pages you are now cutting, because it's not about the reader. You know, Blaise Pascal famously said, anything written to please the author is worthless.
Right. So one true sentence can emerge in the editing process just as easily as it can happen in the creation process.
Oh, I think so. Oh, yeah. So you can begin with the one true sentence, or I think you can finally stumble your way into it. You know, Gail Godwin has this great line. She said, the writer must clear her throat before she sings. I've done a lot of damn.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I had to write those 50 pages before I got to, it was morning. Okay, fine. Here we go.
Yeah. I'm interested in another sentence in Hills Like White Elephants. I wonder if I could impose on you. Please. So there's a one sentence paragraph. So it's really an awfully simple operation jig. The man said it's not really an operation at all. And then we have a one sentence paragraph. The girl looked at the ground the table legs rested on. And that's got to be one of the most unusual paragraphs or sentences mm-hmm. in American literature. What is Hemingway doing there?
Well, look, I'm a big believer that our job is to step into the dream world. And I would bet you that Hemingway would not tell you he was doing that for any symbolic or motif or thematic reason. I think it was there because he believed that that is what she was doing. She was actually looking in. And of course, there are all sorts of metaphorical. We can really go nuts on the symbolism of that, right? Give me a line again.
The girl looked at the ground the table legs rested on.
Yeah. You know, we could argue, you know, she's looking at her entire life. Table legs are this rocky relationship. You know, will they be able to, you know, on and on. We could go on with that. I think Hemingway is simply trying to capture what the true experience is here and give it to us. Now, we have to say, though, what's really remarkable about Hills Like White Elephants, it's told in the very rare third person objective, right? Which is, you know, there are 4 direct methods of excavating character: dialogue, action, physical description, and the mother lode for the writer, which is the interior life. There is very little interior life in that story. Right. Maybe there a little bit, and then there's the line where the man looked down at the train tracks, didn't see the train. But the deepest we go in is that, you know, and this is the line I was almost going to give you instead of the first, which is they were all waiting reasonably for the train, right? Go inside the man there.
You go inside the man by going inside the people waiting for the train. So the man is even mentioned in that sentence, but you know more about him than at any other point in the story.
And let me say this. One of the, maybe the central thing that I admire most about Hemingway's short stories, probably even more than his novels, is the respect he holds for the reader to get it. Part of the art, and he was the pioneer of this, is the finishing part of it is what the reader brings to it. His or her life, everything we've lived, all we've lost, all we've loved and lost, all we fear, all we regret, all we desire, where we've traveled, where we haven't. We bring all of that to these moments. And Hemingway trusts us. There's a great line from Bill Moyers. The silence after Mozart is Mozart's too.
Yeah.
Isn't that beautiful? And I think that that silence, that restraint, shows such respect for the reader from Hemingway.
And maybe the one other final aspect of Hills Like White Elephants we can talk about, Andre, with that point in mind, is the dialogue.
Yes.
Which is so spare. And most of this story is dialogue, and you barely get any speech tags, right? And you certainly don't get any big verbs or adverbs that coach you on how to read the dialogue. And so is that your sort of practice when you compose dialogue?
Well, yes. And I want to talk about Elizabeth Bowen, who famously said that dialogue is what characters do to one another. You know, it's not, you know, one of the many reasons I can't watch soap operas is that everything that one character says to another is fully responded to with great articulation and thoroughness. The only time I've ever gotten that kind of dialogue is paying someone $150 an hour in therapy to listen to me and report back to me what I did. For most of us, it's a cluster, you know what. Can I just read a piece of this dialogue, my favorite?
Yeah, of course, of course.
So this is the girl stood up and walked to the end of the station. Across on the other side were fields of grain and trees along the banks of the Ebro. Far away beyond the river were mountains. The shadow of a cloud moved across the field of grain, and she saw the river through the trees. And we could have all this, she said. And we could have everything, and every day we make it more impossible. What'd you say? I said we could have everything. We can have everything. No, we can't. We can have the whole world. No, we can't. We can go everywhere. No, we can't. It isn't ours anymore. It's ours. No, it isn't. And once they take it away, you never get it back. But they haven't taken it away. We'll wait and see. Come on back in the shade, he said. You mustn't feel that way. I don't feel any way, the girl said. I just know things.
Oh. Yeah.
It's a frigging symphony. It's a solo, a violin solo. It's it's such a wonderful epitome of that Bowen line that this dialogue is what characters do to one another.
And then, Andre, just continue for 1 second because you got to get to the end. Do you feel better? He asked. I feel fine, she said. There's nothing wrong with me. I feel fine.
Yes.
And that last line could be said 25 different ways. And when you're saying Hemingway trusts us, he trusts you to read it your way or the true way or the right way. How do you read that last? How does the story end for you?
Oh, for me personally?
Sure.
Oh, they're screwed. They're screwed. Stepping out at the rail station, having a beer, having an anise before they get back on the train. She may very well get the procedure he wants her to get, and I don't want to say it out loud in case someone hasn't read this story yet, but she knows that they are through. There's so much gray in this. There's so much gray. And I'm still not convinced that she's going to leave him. I'm still not convinced that she's going to stop loving him. I am convinced that she's feeling deeply at this moment something very clear, which is he does not love her and maybe never has. And it's all between the lines. And the great master has trusted us to get it because we're people too.
Would you please read your one true sentence one more time, Andre?
It would be an honor. The hills across the valley of the Ebro were long and white.
Andre Debuse III, thank you for joining us on One True Podcast.
It's been a joy, man. Thanks so much for having me.
And thanks to you all for listening in. This episode is available on HemingwaySociety.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Follow us on Twitter at One True Pod. That's the number One True Pod. Or email us at onetruepod@gmail.com. Our show is supported by the Hemingway Society, the English Department of the University of Evansville, and Florida Gulf Coast University. Join us next time as we continue exploring Hemingway, his work, and his world. Until then, I'm Mark Chirino with Michael Von Cannon, and this is One True Podcast.